It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover and a lot of local stuff this week. Starting out with the city council, they had a vote this last Monday.
Yeah, they voted on budget items on Monday, and they approved the $30 million for the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project. But apparently the money is...
I love that they call it a beautification project. They can't even bring themselves to say that it might actually improve traffic, because it won't.
They don't. They call it the fix for the Mercer mess. Well, it's not. It's really the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project, which is pretty much just what it amounts to. But the money is... I guess the money isn't going to be spent right away. It's going to just sit around for a while until the DOT provides information on the funding shortfall, because, of course, they don't have all the money to finish the project, and because they're holding back details of the environmental impact statement. Some of the money, however, is going to be spent for design and for finishing up property purchases that were put on hold. Which means that, yeah, some of it will be used to buy property, even though they say it's not going to. But there was a little bit of good news in the budget proceedings, wasn't there, Job?
Yes. Are you going to tell us what that was?
No, I thought you were going to talk about it as well.
Oh, you know, talk about the jail?
The jail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The good news on the jail front was that they are not proceeding directly anyway to the possibility of building a new jail. What they're going to do first, although the city has subsequently announced that they've expanded their list of possible siting for the jail, they're also going to fund a pilot project looking at alternatives to reduce the rate of possible incarceration that Nick Licata sponsored. He sponsored the proposal. It's not that he's sponsoring the incarceration. And the idea being that if you can do a pre-arrest diversion project in order to get nonviolent drug offenders into treatment, that it saves them going through the justice system, and it cuts dramatically down on the recidivism later. Right now, you have, in many cases, because of the funding shortfalls in the prosecutor's office, people who are arrested for nonviolent drug offenses simply plea out, and therefore they don't have any kind of court-mandated treatment programs, etc., and they're much more likely to wind up back in the justice system later. And the idea behind this, according to Licata and some of the other critics of a new jail, is that since the vast majority of the jail population, both for the city and for the county, are nonviolent drug offenders from the war on drugs, that if you decrease those number of offenders, you can possibly decrease them sufficiently that you won't actually need new jail space. So this actually, surprisingly enough, carried the day at city council, and so we'll spend, I believe, $4.5 million. It's not that much. But anyway, the SPD actually has a pilot project looking at this kind of diversion program that has been fairly promising so far. So they put some more money into that, and we'll see if they wind up funding a new jail next year. But it got put off a little bit this year.
Yeah, that's good news. And I think it makes absolute sense for them to do that, because King County right now is looking at cutting their budget. And one of the ways that they've decided is a way to do that is to direct the King County Sheriff's Office and to focus on the hardcore crimes, and for the county justice system to try to decrease the number of people who are thrown into jail for drug-related crimes, particularly just for crimes of possession.
All right. Meanwhile, over at the mayor's office, it looks like they're going to be pushing for a gun ban in the city of Seattle.
Yes, it was announced. Well, we actually talked about this about a month and a half ago, when yet another in the seemingly inexhaustible supply of senseless shootings, Nichols came out with a proposal to ban guns on public places and essentially public buildings and parks. And this he announced yesterday, I believe it was, that that law, it's actually not a law, it doesn't have to pass city council. He's going to do it by regulation, that will go into effect next month. This is basically Nichols posturing for the cameras and costing the city a lot of money doing it, because it is going to be as soon as anybody is detained on this, it's going to wind up in court and it's going to get thrown out. The city is claiming that, well, since the city is the property owner, we have the same rights as any private property owner of banning guns on private property. But courts have ruled that, no, when the city owns land, it's not private property belonging to the city, it's public property.
Yeah.
That's the fine line that Nichols is trying to walk here, and he's just not going to get away with it. So, you know, he's trying to look good, and I'm certainly, you know, I'm not particularly sympathetic to the idea of concealed weapons, but, you know, being a possible problem. But the shootings that have prompted this, the people involved were, I believe the one at Folklife that originally produced this. I think there was another Seattle Center event later on that was also a gun incident. But the idea that somehow you're going to make it illegal and this will stop people from carrying concealed weapons is just ludicrous. It's already illegal to carry them in a concert setting, and that didn't stop this from happening. So it's basically just Nichols posturing for the media and trying to look good, and it's going to cost taxpayers as a result, because it's going to get thrown out.
All right. Moving on to other financial news, the King County is looking at a bus increase.
Oh, yeah, King County.
A bus fare increase.
There you go.
Well, yeah.
Well, they're going to bus increase, too, with the transportation.
Yeah, King County announced that they're struggling with somewhere near a $90 million deficit for the county budget. And as a part of that, they announced two bus fare increases. The first increase, a 25-cent fare increase, will go into effect February 1st, 2009, early next year. And then the next fare increase will go into effect in January of 2010, another 25-cent increase. And this is going to generate somewhere around $9.5 million in 2009, and they're estimating around $20 million in 2010. But it's not going to be enough to close the gap in Metro Transit's budget. Ron Sims had proposed that Metro Transit dip into their cash reserves to cover the deficit in the short term, and the deficit being caused by two things. First, the higher fuel prices this year, and although fuel prices have come down, there's no guarantee they're going to stay down. And then the second thing that caused the deficit is the lack of sales tax revenue coming into the county, into the Metro Transit budget, because that's the primary source of funds for the county. It really points up the peril of relying on a sales tax versus an income tax. In any given year, people can cut back on their spending immediately, and it can have a huge impact on your local government budgets and on the state budget, as we'll talk about later. But if it's based on your income tax, well, you have to put a lot of people out of work for that to make an equally big impact on your local and state budgets.
At which point they'd be cutting back on spending anyway.
Yeah, well, they may or may not be cutting back on spending, but at that point there would be other issues to take into account as well. And sure, they may be cutting back on their spending by laying people off as well at the state and local levels. So I think it makes a lot more sense. Obviously, this is an illustration of why of the argument for an income tax versus a sales tax. But Ron Sims had wanted to direct Metro to dip into their cash reserves to cover the deficit, which he expected to only last a couple of years this next year and in 2010. And the county council said, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, we got to save those and save those and save those and save those for who knows what emergency, as if the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression is not an emergency. The King County Council said, oh, no, we're going to direct Metro to trim their expenses, which means if Metro, once they've trimmed some of their administrative expenses, can't plug the hole, they're going to have to cut back on service at a time when the demand for Metro Transit service is at an all-time high.
All right. Moving on to state transportation solutions, developments with the viaduct and 520.
Yeah, the state announced this week the estimated costs for two of our largest transportation infrastructure projects. The viaduct, no surprise, of the options that they're considering, of course, the cheapest option is a tear down and a surface boulevard, which the estimate comes in at around $800 to $900 million, so just under $1 billion. A replacement with a new elevated highway comes in at $1.6 billion for a simple replacement, up to $2.2 billion if you want to throw in a park and some office space, as Frank Chopp has suggested. The tunnel, I can't believe this, that people are still talking about a tunnel to replace the viaduct, but they still are, comes in at a low estimate of $3.5 billion. I think that's an extremely low estimate. I think it's more likely to be double that. But
didn't people vote against that by like 75%?
Yes, which is why I don't understand why the state is still talking about the tunnel option. Of course, Nichols, primarily Nichols and the Downtown Business Association, primarily are the cause for that. And you know, you can't really expect Greg Nichols to do anything else, because really the Downtown Business Association is his core constituency, and they're relying on him to bring home the bacon to bring home millions of dollars to build a tunnel, which will keep developers and construction companies happy. But I should point out the state has committed $2.4 billion for a replacement, but of course the state budget has got a big hole in it, just like the King County budget. So next month, Ron Sims and Chris Gregoire are going to sit down with their aides, and they're going to talk about it and try to make a decision about which option makes the most sense to replace the viaduct. And I'm hoping folks will get on the phone and call Gregoire's office and call Ron Sims and tell them what you think is the best option. I would call and tell them that a teardown and a surface boulevard is sufficient, particularly in these economic times.
All right. And developments with the 520?
The 520 bridge, yeah. The costs range from $4.6 billion on the low end for an option that pretty much nobody likes, to a $6.6 billion option on the high end, which includes all the bells and whistles. The state has budgeted about $3.9 billion and had hoped to collect between $1 and $2 billion in tolls, which means they're going to fall short in funding for the 520 replacement that has everybody on board, including the community groups in the Montlake area who have fought hard against some of the earlier, cheaper options for a 520 replacement. So we'll have to see what happens in this next legislative session. The state legislative session starts in January. It's going to be a slightly longer session this year because they have to work out a two-year budget. And as part of that, they'll be looking at the 520 replacement options. And, you know, the money's just not there right now.
Yeah. And this really, do you want to talk about the state shortfall?
Yeah, the state budget shortfall is it was formerly estimated at $3 billion. Now it's up to $5.1 billion, they announced this week. Gregoire has said that she's committed to no tax increases, which was her main campaign promise. She's going to focus on cuts. Of course, two of the biggest items in the state budget, K-12 education and the state prison system, all have legally mandated minimum funding levels. So there isn't a whole lot that can be cut there. That leaves the cuts in places like higher education and social and health services. I'm guessing that higher education is going to win out because it has more vocal advocates and advocates with more money and more clout behind them than social and health services. But even if the higher education portion of the budget takes some cuts, it's not coming at a good time, because when you have an economic downturn, you have a lot of people who are out of work and need retraining. And we're seeing that right now with our community colleges having record enrollment.
Yeah. And this once again, I mean, Maria made this point before with the local budget, but this really gets back to the question of how our state revenues are structured. That without an income tax, with the dependency on a sales tax
and a property tax, at a time when property values are dropping,
and a dependence on a sector of the economy that over the long term, you know, evened out over the various up and down turns of the economic cycle, is a declining portion of the state's economy. We are hardwired into the idea that we're going to have budget shortfalls, and this is going to be a continuing problem. That being said, just be thankful this news didn't come out a month ago, because if it did, we'd probably be dealing with Governor Rossi.
Yeah, true.
All right.
Although one more thing I want to mention about the state economy, Greg Warris committed to no new taxes. Well, she and the legislature could do quite a bit by closing some of the tax exemptions that exist for business. There are plenty of business tax exemptions. Not all of them make sense. If you close those B&O tax loopholes, particularly, for example, the fuel tax exemption that Boeing gets, it would bring a lot of money into the state budget that could be used to help close some of this budget gap.
All right. Moving on to national, and it's looking like Henry Waxman is going to have a new line to add to his resume.
Yeah, he will be taking over the chairmanship of the House committee that oversees an enormous number of different things having to do with the environment, with global warming, with
Energy,
consumer
protection, healthcare,
the countries,
a lot of things.
The energy and transportation and global warming portion of it was the portion that occasioned essentially a leadership fight between John Dingell, who is the from Detroit, who is the longest serving member of the House of Representatives. He's been in the House since 1955. And Waxman is 20 years as junior. He came in 74 as part of the Watergate class. Waxman, of course, is the guy who's been seemingly the only Democrat in Congress who's been really pretty adamant about trying to investigate the Bush administration over the past couple of years. He's now going to take that sense of energy and mission and apply it to global warming. And there were some fingerprints on this fairly rare inter-party struggle. Most notably those of Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi, of course, from California. She was resentful of Dingell, who has been very much an advocate for the big three automakers over
Dingell
his career.
Dingell is from Michigan.
Yeah, I said he's from Detroit.
He's a real advocate for the Detroit car makers.
Yeah, I said he was from Detroit. Mm-hmm. That he has been one of the primary forces blocking mandatory fuel efficiency standards, blocking things like California's attempt to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And on the latter point, Pelosi, of course, who's from California, this is something of payback for her. And of course, Obama wanted to move forward on global warming issues also after 8 years of Bush administration in action. So this is a very, very good sign that this happened. It's actually probably at least as significant a development in Washington as all the different cabinet appointment speculation that's been going on this week.
Yeah.
All right. And developments this week with prisoners at Guantanamo.
Yeah, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. A federal U.S. District Court judge this week ordered release of five of the six Algerians held at Guantanamo. I talked about how those Algerians had been scooped up in Bosnia. They had emigrated from Algeria and relocated to Bosnia, and how the U.S. government had strong-armed NATO and the Bosnian government to turn them over, even though a Bosnian court had declared them innocent of any charges of terrorism. The U.S. District Court judge said that the government's evidence against these five Algerians was absolutely not credible. It was based on one unidentified source, and he ordered the prisoners who've been held for 7 years to be released immediately. And then he turned around and he warned the Justice Department lawyers not to appeal his decision, which would add two additional years to their unjustifiable imprisonment. So that's some good news for those guys this week.
All right. And economic news for this week.
Yeah. Congress was in session this week, a special session to deal with the economic problems. And they'd come in thinking that they would pass a stimulus package. Well, they got the news from the Bush administration. No, we will not sign a stimulus package. So Congress did the best they could. They passed an extension of unemployment benefits into January, 7 additional weeks of benefits for people who have exhausted their unemployment benefits or who will soon. That's an estimated 1.2 million people who would have lost their benefits by December 31st. In states where unemployment is over 6%, including Washington State, where it's now 6.3%, people would get an additional 13 weeks, and President Bush said that he will, in fact, sign that bill.
Yeah. Now Obama has said that he will have an economic stimulus proposal in January, but of course, you know, that's 2 months away.
Yeah, that's a long time to wait. So this allows people to continue receiving their unemployment benefits until Obama becomes president and can do a real stimulus package. In addition, Congress actually held out against the three big automakers, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, when they pushed them hard and said, we want bailout money. Congress dug in their heels and even scolded them a little bit and asked them, look, are you three CEOs willing to give up some of your bonuses or give up some of your salary if we pass this package? And two of them said yes, and one said, well. So Congress basically said, look, go away, come up with a plan come up with a good reason why you need the $25 billion and what you're willing to do to get it, and let us know by December 2nd what that plan is, and if it's good, we'll call a special session in December to vote on it. So it was good on one hand. They didn't immediately cave in. Congress didn't immediately cave in to the big three automakers. But it was a little bit bad on the other hand because it didn't give them an absolute no. It essentially is allowing the three automakers to write their own meal ticket. So I think in the interim, folks should be calling their congressmen, particularly Nancy Pelosi in the House and Henry, you know, the majority leader in the House and Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, and tell them what you think about giving money to the three big automakers. Call over the holidays, call between now and December 2nd and let them know, because the more pressure we put on them, the less likely they are to just throw the money at them.
All right, any other economic news?
No, let's move on.
All right, that moves us then to international and Iraq.
Yeah, the Bush administration and the American media claiming a big victory this week in the Maliki cabinet approving the security pact that the Bush administration has been trying very hard to ram down their throat. I mean, negotiate with Iraq. It moved on to the parliament, where it's believed that they have enough votes to pass it, but it's over a very, very, very vocal and very large opposition. Ali Sistani, the spiritual leader of Iraq, who's really the power behind behind the Shiite throne in Iraq, has said that he thinks that for something this contentious, it really needs a national consensus, and they are a long way away from any kind of consensus. There were enormous demonstrations, tens of thousands of people in the streets of Baghdad yesterday opposing this plan, and it's something that the Bush administration is trying to close the deal on before they leave office, so that they can try and lock the incoming Obama administration into a continuing presence in Iraq. There is a maybe Iran too, if they really had their
eventually,
way.
Eventually, yeah.
But the question around this, of course, is that even if they can get it through the Iraqi parliament, and you can bet that behind the scenes the Americans are making all kinds of promises and throwing all kinds of money at individual legislators trying to get them to sign off on this over the objections of their constituencies. But There's the question of why this isn't being submitted to the Democratic Congress in the United States. This is something that supposedly the Bush administration is saying, well, we don't have to actually do this. We can do this through the executive branch, but any kind of a treaty or commitment like that with a foreign country, according to the Constitution, has to go through Congress. So you're looking at some kind of a constitutional challenge on that score as well in this country.
Yeah, I think the interesting, really the interesting aspect of all of this is that the Iraqi parliament is how it was received by the Iraqi parliament when the agreement was being read aloud. It was immediately a parliament erupted into fighting and large, and they essentially had to adjourn the parliament for the day in the middle of reading the agreement to the legislators because they were upset about it. It's pretty clear that if a vote were taken today, it would pass by a very slim majority, mainly because the ruling party, the ruling Shiite party, and the Kurds would vote for it, and al-Sadr's Shiite group plus all of the other parties, including the Sunni parties in parliament, would vote against it. And that is very far from the national consensus that al-Sistani and the Iraqi government would like to see and that the U.S. government would like to see. And, of course, if we did bring this to a vote here in the United States in Congress, it wouldn't pass either. And I think also the Iraqi parliament, particularly the minority parties and al-Sadr's Shiite party, would much rather negotiate a deal with President Obama than they would with President Bush. So I think they're going to do everything they can to resist passing something through the Iraqi parliament before December 31st. So we'll see what happens.
And yet, following it from the corporate media, you would have had the impression it was all a done deal this last week.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah. The American media coverage of this was just abominable this week. It was very, very much cheerleading for the Bush administration or the Bush administration's sense of this is a good thing for Iraq and it's a good thing for the United States and everybody loves it. And you know,
are all tied up in Iraq. It's over.
Just in time for Christmas.
Yeah. And not only is this a misrepresentation of how it was received in Iraq, but it's also a fundamental misreading of what people in this country want with the war. Most people in this country want to see the U.S. out of Iraq. Polls are consistently showing that around 70% of the population feels that way, and the idea that a unilateral deal by an extremely unpopular administration to commit us to three more years in Iraq is somehow good news is just shows how oblivious media coverage in this country is too.
Right, and they've downplayed how the agreement is helping push Iraq down the road towards civil war because it really is an extremely contentious issue, and it's highlighting the differences in the main parties in Iraq rather than bringing them together in a national consensus like they say they want. So, you know, the fact that our media isn't paying attention to that and it's not page one or page two news, it's in the back of the paper, that's bad.
And it's not on the evening newscast at all.
All right. How about events for this week?
Just one that's kind of worth mentioning, which is the day after Thanksgiving traditionally is Buy Nothing Day. So this is an event that you actually don't have to go out and do. You can stay home and not do.
Spend time with your family.
Exactly. Or you know, knit something.
Or spend time at home resting after you've been assaulted by your family, for those of us who don't have great family relationships.
Well, and with the economy going the way it is, it's things are looking up for Buy Nothing Day.
Yeah.
That's very
gonna
true.
Going to turn it into Buy Nothing Month.
Buy All Nothing right. Year. Buy Nothing, yeah.
Uh-huh. Talking with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
Eat This State comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, etc. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. A couple of things coming up to mention, which is we agreed that to do on Inauguration Day, we're going to have a benefit at the Comedy Underground. So we'll be giving you more details on that as it comes up, but it should be a lot of fun. And then every year at the end of the year, we do something called the Overhyped and Underreported Stories of the Year. And we would love to have your input this year on what you think the most overhyped and worthless stories of the year were, and also the ones that should have gotten more attention than they did. So if you have suggestions along that line, or if you have any kind of comments, feedback, tips, please email to us at editorial or info at eatthestate.org, editorial at eatthestate.org, or info at eatthestate.org. And if you want to get a hold of us by voicemail, that number is area code 206-719-6947.